Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Laurie Miller is speaking on biblical ethics and purity. So let's listen in on Laurie.
Part of what I want the class to be is not me just lecturing, but some good discussion from your insight and experience, because I think that is a lot more interesting. Something that is not reflected in the title is that I'm not just going to be talking about biblical ethics, but biblical sexual ethics. And that's where the purity issue comes in. So today I'm going to be, first of all, explaining a little bit what purity is, purity law, and then talking a little bit about the world of the ancient Hebrews in the time before Jesus. Before I go any farther, however, I have to give credit where credit is due. almost all of my reasoning and rationale behind this class comes from Bill Countryman's book called Dirt, Greed, and Sex. And these are available in the bookstore, and I really recommend the book. It's a sort of thing, it's kind of dense reading, but if you're interested in this, I think it is the best book I've read on the subject of contemporary sexual ethics for people of faith. It's in paperback, so it's a little cheaper in the bookstore. Bill Countryman is an Episcopal priest and also a professor at Church Divinity School of the Pacific, which is one of the seminaries in the Berkeley, San Francisco Bay Area. And when I was in seminary, I studied this book in his class. Before I go any farther, I would like, there's a lot of you, but it's interesting to know in a class like this what you expect. So if you could just in a couple of sentences introduce yourself and say what interests you in this topic. I'll begin, and I'm Laurie Miller. And what interests me in the topic particularly is the controversy, particularly in all mainline denominations now, of including homosexuals in the church. And I think that looking at issues of purity are part of that issue.
I didn't know at all what to expect. My name is Barbara Kite. I read biblical ethics and I thought, that sounds very interesting.
Good.
Yeah, good. And what you've said interests me.
Good. Thank you. And it will, like I say, I'm really talking about sexual ethics, but some of what I'm going to be talking about in terms of the context of the Hebrew Scripture and New Testament will apply more broadly to.
My name is Evan Kite, and I really didn't know exactly what to expect either. If you'd written something about sex, then I would have had more of an idea.
Yeah, I probably should have put there. You know, we're limited to 40 characters on our titles for the Tate Ministry, but maybe I should have put sex in parentheses or something.
Why do you think you're being sensationalist?
Yeah, well, this title, let me tell you, Dirt, Greed, and Sex, that'll do it. Thanks.
I'm Howard Baumgart, and I guess I just thought of this ethics in a broader sense.
Welcome.
It's fine.
And if anyone's uncomfortable, they can leave before I start the lecture, since it wasn't in the title.
I'm Lori Petrovich, and I'm here with the purity part, but also it was because I've been impressed by you throughout the week, watching you and hearing you talk a little bit. And I've been trying to get into a class to keep the teaching.
Oh, thank you.
First chance I've had.
Glad you're here.
I'm glad I got it.
Go ahead. Thanks.
My name is Lita, and I'm with Barbara. I wasn't exactly sure what it was all about, and I was thinking of ethics in a broader view.
Okay.
This is one area of it.
Okay. Thanks.
My name is Don Sippy, and I'm interested in the ethics of, you know, from the Bible, because I read in the newspaper about all these different ethics, and some of these books almost convince you that ethics are out of style or whatever, and so trying to think of this is, would be more back to the basics.
Yes, thank you. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah.
Well, why don't sitting in front of you. Yeah. Could you just tell us your name and what interests you in the class?
Lillian Parker from Austin, Texas. And I think I'm in the wrong place.
Oh, okay. Are we looking at psychiatry? It's next door. That happens a lot. That's one of the reasons why. I'd be in there if I weren't teaching this one.
I'm Daniel Glassman. I'm from the cities. I was raised in a really strict Christian community, and I disagreed with a lot of what they taught, and I had no idea what this about. And I almost didn't come to the Bible ethics, I just didn't want to think about it. But I think it'll be good for me.
Good, I'm glad you came.
And I'm Martha Olson, and ethics and purity, I guess I don't know what I was, not what we're going to get, but
okay.
That's fine.
Okay.
I know it's an issue, and so it'll be interesting to hear some ideas on it.
Thank you. Karen?
Karen Bloomquist. I did know what the title was about. I did, in fact, I taught a series on this book 2 or 3 years ago. So just wanted to hear what Laura had to say about it.
Thanks.
And I'm Ann Scott, and I just thought it sounded interesting, and I'm trying to take in as much as I can here. So
good. Glad you're here.
Maybe I'll find out.
I'm Hope Nettergaard from Nebraska, and I just thought biblical ethics sounded interesting, but I had no idea what to expect.
Okay. I think I'm going to have to be a little more specific on my title next time.
I'm Gail Graf-Mulner from Bellingham, Washington. Just need as much Bible information.
I'm Gary Graf-Wallner from Bellingham, Washington, and I didn't know what I was about.
Yay.
I helped create countrymen's book.
Good. I'll be interested in your feedback.
I'm Daryl Brodhouse from Seattle, and I grew up in the holiness revivalistic tradition where purity of heart and life was a cultic incantation.
Yeah.
And I, like the lady back there, pretty well dismissed that notion because it seemed to be so narrow and so rigidly understood. But in the last year or two, I've begun to sort of sniff around that notion of purity again. So that was hit my hot button when I saw that.
I'll be really interested in your experience, if it fits in here. And one thing I like to do with groups, what's a little different about this group, I've taught this class before, what's different is I know that you're not all going to be here the next day, but I still would like to just lay out some group norms, because these are going to be our rules. You know, we're talking about law, so I'm going to lay it down. But it's in most part giving protection and safety in this group, whoever's here, so that we can really talk about things of substance. And if anyone's experience comes into this, I will welcome that. The norms that I really want here, and I have to tell you, I've taught this class twice now, and I'm still not real comfortable talking about sex. And you really can't talk about sexual ethics without talking about sex to some degree. And, but so honesty is one. Confidentiality. So whatever is said in here, we can talk about confidentiality. We can discuss it in here, but with understanding, except for ideas we won't share outside. I think we need to agree that we're going to disagree. especially getting into the topics we're talking about. And I'll just say from the heart, that's what I've been discovering of people in Holden, so I don't think there's a problem. And respect. We probably haven't gotten into this enough, but are there any that you would like to add now that you felt would feel more comfortable about? If what we'll do is later, we'll just add it. If we find we're getting into something knee-high and we need to add, we will. I want to say a little bit about biblical ethics in general. First of all, you've probably experienced, as I have, that when it comes to knowing what the Bible says about any given issue, that interpreters don't always agree. And in fact, the Bible can be used to support widely varying points of view. And what Bill Countryman attempts in his book, and what we will attempt in this class, is to approach the Bible with a fresh and careful reading and understanding. And the caution about that, don't expect that what we're going to talk about the Bible saying, or our interpretation of the Bible, to necessarily agree with your presuppositions. Jan said an interesting thing this morning in talking about the Gospel of Mark in the Bible study. She said that a professor of hers told her that if there are two different interpretations or translations or two different ancient manuscripts, that if you are trying to decide which one was right, they disagree, the two manuscripts disagree. If you're trying to decide which was the most original, probably go with the one that's the hardest to understand. And I don't think that's just professors trying to be obscure, but I think it's recognizing that when we try to understand what the Bible has to say, we are like trying to understand language from people of another culture with which we are not familiar. That's true in both the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, and the New Testament. That's not to say that we're going to give up on it, and that's why I'm particularly pleased those of you who saw Bible ethics, you know, were a little nervous, because what I think is very important is being able to claim our Scripture and to struggle with it and find in it for today, in the context of that foreign culture in which it was written, what is meaningful for today. And I want to say a little bit about the distinction between morality and ethics. A definition of morality that I find helpful is that morality and mores in a culture are norms that are accepted by the culture. They're generally accepted. That's just the way things are. In our culture, the norm is for a man in marriage, a model of marriage that's norm in our culture, a moral marriage, is a man and a woman, one man, one woman married, with the intention to make that marriage last a lifetime. Although that's not as binding as it used to be in terms of what is acceptable. In the Old Testament, there's a very big difference in that a man could have many wives and concubines, and that is a different, accepted, moral life that we encounter in reading Scripture. So morality are norms of behavior that are accepted in the community, and they vary from culture to culture. So what seems moral and right to us is not going to be the same thing that seems normal and right in another culture necessarily. Ethics are the principles that explain why the mores and why the morals are the way they are. So beyond being the custom. So for example, I'm not an expert in this, but I'm just doing this off the top of my head, but I would say an ethic in our one ethic of explaining why our more of one man marrying one woman in our culture is right, because that's what we recognize as the custom, as the accepted norm. An ethic might be that is a just and fair and equal union. I mean, it's not, I'm not saying that that's the only just and fair, but that could be an ethic supporting the morality of marriage in our culture. Do you have any questions about that distinction between mores and ethics? The reason I'm even bringing that up is because what we're going to be looking at in this section on purity and purity in the life of the ancient Hebrews is, as I said, we're going to be encountering another culture, and some of it is going to be strange. I mean, have any of you read Leviticus all the way through the book of Leviticus? Okay, so some of you. It's not generally one that we read for devotion or uplifting experiences, but that's what we're going to be focusing on, and we're going to try to get into that a little bit tonight, and that is the heart of the Old Testament law. And so for the Hebrew people in the time before Jesus, this heart of the law that is going to have much to do with purity was the basis for morality. And some of what you're saying about purity and holiness, that our understanding of purity and holiness are very, very different. And we'll see that as we get into the material. So I'm just going to give a little... Now, one final thing before I just talk a little bit about what purity is. You're going to be tempted as you read Leviticus and as I explain what the ancient Hebrews thought about purity, you're going to be tempted to think, this is so different, you know, how could they have lived like this? What's been very interesting has been, as I've read this and talked with my husband and taught the classes, I have realized we very much have our own purity code. And that's the fun part. And we're going to talk about that today and some tomorrow, and it'll probably still keep popping up the rest of the week. To some degree, every society has purity codes. Purity codes have to do with order and disorder. And a purity system is one that divides dirty from the clean. And it's also a way of understanding what it means to be a human being. For example, I'll come back to this a lot, but a lot of parenting is teaching, well, not a lot, some of parenting, a little bit of it, and sort of civilizing and bringing into life and raising up a child is teaching what's dirty and what's clean. You know, you can't wear dirty clothes all week, and you can't put your food on your shirt. And that, in our culture, educating about what's clean and what's dirty is part of education. Because at some point, a child or a person who continues to mix up what's dirty and what's clean is not going to be socially, not going to be accepted by his or her friends. Even though different cultures have different ways of understanding what's clean and dirty, there is a consistency about what we do label as dirty. One definition of dirt that I think is most helpful is matter out of place. Dirt is matter that's out of place. What the consistent, if you look across world cultures and human societies, if you look to see what is considered dirty, it usually has to do with human orifices. And that's real scholarly sounding, but that's the nicest way I know to say it. It's the food, it's waste, it's it has to do with sexuality, it has to do with birth, and it even has to do with death, because there's a boundary there going from life to death. And we read in both in the Old Testament and, you know, in the story of the Good Samaritan, the man who's beaten is passed by the priest and the Levite because there's a prohibition against touching a corpse. But in all cultures, some of the taboos about clean and unclean have to do with birth, death, foods, waste products, shed blood, menstrual blood, and sexual acts. Purity is avoiding the dirt. And like I said, what's dirty is not self-evident. That's why we have to teach children. And that's why I've lived in Sweden. That's another culture. I'm thinking people who go from one culture to another also need to learn to some degree what is considered clean and unclean. The first time I taught this class, I had in my class someone who had lived with a family in some rural place. I believe it was in Africa. But it was a very far-flung place. And the way of cleaning dishes was to use cow manure. That was the cleaning of the dishes, which, well, that really hit my purity button. I don't know about you, but the very trickiest thing about this for us is to find out where our own purity rules are. That's an easy one. But sometimes we know when we've hit a purity issue when we have a gut reaction, like, okay, it's acceptable to eat escargot in a fancy French restaurant, but what's your reaction to slugs on a plate? And I don't know, for people who live in Oregon and Washington, you see a lot of slugs. Usually, when you experience a feeling of repulsion about something, you may be crossing a purity boundary. Purity law has been a strong force in this country, especially in the area of sexuality. And if you think about it, think about our words. There's dirty books, dirty films, dirty old man, sorry. I was just thinking of the common one. Let's see. Dirty-minded. We have in our language associated what's sexual with dirt. And what's very interesting, the Countryman talks about in his introduction about the force of purity in our culture in the 50s, that there was a very strong taboo against any sexual activity outside of marriage. And not everyone who believed that went to church. It wasn't all just a religious prohibition. It was in the culture. And that changed dramatically in the 60s and has been changing since. But as a force, purity law has had and has its reign in our culture now. What's really hard to define, or what's hard to figure out if what your issue is about purity or not, is that it seems self-evident. Let me think of an example here. It's not because we may think something is wrong, and if it's so self-evident, we're not even going to question it. But a clue to finding those places are where you have the gut reaction. The thing back with washing the dishes with the cow manure. You know, I've had a long discussion with people in classes about, you know, well, it's sanitation, you know, you're going to get germs and you'll die. And And I thought, well, I guess that's true. We have science to know that bacteria causes diseases. But people do live in different conditions than we do. And they survive and they die of diseases, and we do too. And so what is self-evident is not always true. And what is really self-evident that causes a gut reaction may be a purity issue. So what I'm going to try to help us do is to see which of our sexual ethics come from our purity rules. And maybe we'll touch enough on that tonight for you to get an idea about that, but we'll be getting into that more, especially on Thursday and Friday. And I'm going to see if we can find that an ethical framework that is found in the teaching of Jesus that really addresses purity and goes beyond that. And I'll be talking about that on Wednesday. Now, before I say anything more, I would just like, this is the fun part, to ask you all if you can think of any purity customs in your household when you were a child, or purity issues that are alive today. And I'll just start with one. This isn't for my household as a child, but in teaching the class, I heard of a purity rule. This is sort of a dirty rule that I heard from someone in the class, actually several people. There's sort of this 10-second rule that if you're cooking in the kitchen and you drop something on the floor, if you can pick it up within 10 seconds, it's okay. But if it's after 10 seconds, it's dirty. But that's just one. Anyone have any? And I'll give you an example. This is from my husband's childhood. He grew up in suburbs of Chicago. And he can remember being told by his aunt and his mother that when he went downtown, not to touch the banisters of the stairs or railings because they were dirty. And he understood that was because there were black people touching those places. So that was a purity thing. He learned they didn't have to tell them why. He just learned that was dirty. Can any of you think of other?
I was told not to pick my nose in either.
That's probably one we all, and it never killed you, right? You know. Any others? That's a good one.
To always cover toilet seats in public restrooms.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When I recently flew from Chicago to Kentucky, or flew through Chicago, and I was so amazed that they have these little buttons in the women's restroom. Have you been to the Chicago airport? You push this little red button, and there's a little plastic thing that rotates around. It's a cover that rotates around the toilet seat. Wow. So you've got a totally little sanitized place to sit every time. And that really struck me. I mean, that's purity at its strongest. And that's partly for it to work, too, isn't it?
This is knowledge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not any feeling.
There's both. I mean, we do know about germs and viruses and bacteria, and we know all of that, and we know that if you pick up germs from someone who's got a cold, you may be infected.
Like even here at the village, one of the things they said was to watch out for these napkin holders because there's chrome napkin, basket, or napkin. Everybody's handling that napkin holder.
That's interesting.
And it was passing a lot of flu germs around.
Yeah. Well, Well, that's a good point, and you're
so
right.
Wear gloves when you pass.
Yeah, I'm thinking, whoa, I just did that tonight. That, yes, you're right. There, we have a degree of sophistication and knowledge about bacteria that obviously people in the Old Testament didn't have. That's true, and also that is, I'm convinced that that's not, some of our purity is not just sanitary. Sometimes we go to great lengths in the name of sanitation, but really the issue is something else. For example, why was my husband's mother and aunt only concerned about him going to downtown Chicago and touching the banisters and the railings and not in his own school? I mean, there are germs there too, but, you know, and they knew about germs, but it was just, so it depends on the situation.
I was always told never to, if you handle money, mm-hmm. never, like,
Put
money in your mouth or anything like that because of that. And if you handle money a lot,
right.
Like if you're a cashier or something like that, always wash your hands.
Right.
Because of the germs and stuff mm-hmm. on there. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of stuff that's a lot more dirty than money, you know, to
that's
handle
true.
And stuff like
that's
that.
True.
You don't get that worked up.
That's true. That's interesting. Yeah. That, you know, there may be something about money and purity there I've never thought about, you know. Yeah, really.
Yeah, but the ancient Greeks, that's the way they carried their money. They put it in their mouths.
Well, and you know, actually, that reminds me, I have heard explanations when we get into the Old Testament law. I've heard people explain it, well, the reason you can't boil, or that the reason that they had these laws was for sanitation. It was like an early understanding of sanitation. And I really don't think that's right. I'm pretty convinced now that it is a religious, it was a way of defining the boundaries of the people and the culture, and probably not a sanitation thing. And I do, like you say, with our knowledge today, there are some reasons, scientific reasons, but we do still also have purity laws. Let me think of another thing. Well, look at the area of sex. I'm not going to ask you to say aloud, but I would be willing to guess that at least some of us received messages as children about not touching ourselves, or, you know, that's dirty. Playing doctor is a dirty thing.
I'll share an experience I had. I had absolutely no sexual education at home at all. It was just a taboo subject. And I was 2 days away from getting married, just the day before I graduated from college, and I was getting married the day afterwards. And my dad, I was getting ready to go off to graduate school, he was just very concerned that I was going to get my wife pregnant and I wouldn't be able to continue graduate school. So he could hardly talk to me. He was so embarrassed. And he called me in the bathroom. The bathroom shut the door, gave me a package of rubbers, as we call them in those days, and said, "Now, Daryl, you need to use these so you can keep going to graduate school." And he couldn't get out of the bathroom. Now, I thought it was instructive that he did this, you know, his foray into sex education would be in the bathroom.
That's really good. I mean, that sort of is human waste and sex. Yeah. And the
in secret.
Yeah. Right. That's good. Any other examples or things that come to mind?
Well, I've been reading this book, you know, None of These Diseases, and one of them, they're saying there that the Jews require circumcision, and he's a doctor who wrote this book, and there's a many more, a higher percentage of people uncircumcised that have, you know, that pick up, I forget the name of it, and
you know, so what they were, you know, taught, that was a religious thing. But yet the Jews always were quite cleanly about washing, too, more than those other ancient people.
Well, we're going to get into the washing.
By the way, that's a pretty interesting book.
What's it called?
You know, that None of These Diseases. Huh. And it's written by a doctor, and he, you know, one of the biggest things he stresses on diseases is, you know, he's telling about this one fella, he's a boss, and he hated this guy, he was mad at him all the time, and the doctor told him he was going to have to avoid it, and he eventually died of a heart attack. But he tells a lot in there how a lot of these diseases are caused by mental stress and like that.
No. It sounds good.
That's but anyway, it's a good book to read.
I think I'm going to say a little bit about. Oh, actually, before I move on, I had asked a second question too, and we'll come back to it. But did anyone? Can you think of any other purity issues that are alive today? I mentioned the issue of homosexuality, which I think is, in large part, a purity issue. And I can give you an example of one of the reasons why I think that's true. I can remember in college, I went to a Christian college in Oklahoma, related to the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which is was a fairly liberal school. But in the heart of Oklahoma, there were a lot of rather conservative people, and I was pretty sheltered. At that point in my life, didn't know anyone who said they were homosexual. I probably knew people, but I didn't know. And I remember having a conversation with a male friend my age, and we were talking about homosexuality. And I was really kind of wrestling, you know, what's wrong about this? And we were having this philosophical conversation, and his name was Erwin. I remember his body language. He was just like this. You know, he was so uncomfortable. And all he could tell me, and he was, you know, he was not hung up on biblical concerns. He wasn't thinking about it from the Bible standpoint. He was just upset. I can't remember exactly the words he used, but he was clearly, whatever it was that made him know that homosexuality was wrong was also making him red in the face and clutching his stomach. And I've thought, since I've read this book, that I think this was really giving him a repulsive reaction, and that if that's a clue to discovering what purity is, that for him, that was a big part of the issue.
I come from quite a large family, not from aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and nephews and nieces, and I had an uncle that was a homosexual, and we all knew it, but nobody ever talked about it. We didn't even discuss it among ourselves until we got older, and then we, you know, said, well, Charlie was a homosexual. But what was interesting to me was the fact that on his deathbed, he was 84 years old, and he told his sister that he was a homosexual. So this obviously was something that bothered him, was impure.
Yeah, that's sad.
He ever mentioned it his whole life.
Until he died.
Yeah.
It's interesting thinking about that and the thing about the boundaries. One of the things when we get into people for ancient Israel, that the law was a way of defining who they were, especially in a time when they were wandering and not able to congregate in their temple and needing to be able to identify themselves, that the law, one very, very important aspect of the law was defining who they were. And so their purity and what became pure within the law and dirty outside of it was the boundary between them and profane religions that they were not supposed to worship. I mentioned the thing about my husband's experience as a child. I think racism is another purity issue. It's, in fact, some of the language, I won't get off into all that, but I think racism is a purity issue to some degree. And when you think of, I actually have come to a point, you may not agree with me, and that's fine, but I've come to a point where I think that most isms, to some degree in our culture, may have a purity aspect to it. And maybe that just means it's drawing the boundaries, and whoever's on the other side of that boundary, we may not think it consciously, but they're out in the dirt. And, you know, the pure realm is the one that includes us, and we're clear about that. I'm going to go ahead and just say a little bit about the law for the ancient Hebrew people. At the beginning of the Common Era, to be a Jew meant to be a certain people. And it's very different from our understanding today. Today we think of faith as being something you profess or something you choose to be. But for people in ancient Israel, for the people who received the law from Moses, that actually defined their whole personhood and their whole culture. It meant that their identity came from belonging to a family, to a nation, to a tribe. And you couldn't convert. You couldn't convert to another denomination. You couldn't even be secular in that society, because to be outside of your clan or your tribe in ancient Israel was basically to be a non-person. There was one of the reasons why there's such a concern in the law for widows and for orphans is because those people were in danger of having no support, no place, because the basic structure, and I'll talk about this in more detail in a couple days, but the basic structure was about the father, the patriarch, and the wife or wives, and the children, and the slaves, and everyone, the brother-in-law and the wife of the brother-in-law, and your identity was that of the Hebrew people. So you couldn't be secular. I don't think, if you were to say, well, I don't want to sacrifice at the temple for my impurity, if you were to do that, in some cases you could be stoned, so you would be non-existent. In other cases, I think you could just be outcast, and you would, that would not be a life that you would want. I refer to the Old Testament as the Hebrew Bible, and in that we have the Torah, and that includes the Ten Commandments, and it also includes a larger law. And I've written up here, we may have a little bit of time to look at some of this today. Leviticus 11 through 26 is the heart of where you're going to find the law, the Old Testament law. And 11 through 16 is the passage that describes the boundaries and describes the purification rituals. Leviticus 17 through 26, which is called the Holiness Code, actually tells what happens if the people defy or don't follow this purification code. So what's interesting is the law doesn't say you can't be unclean sometimes. What the first part of Leviticus says in 11 through 16 is it's recognizing it's impossible. I shouldn't say impossible. It's very, very unlikely for a person to be able to stay clean, because things happen, like women menstruate and then they're unclean. Or women give birth. And it's interesting, if they give birth to a male child, they're only unclean for 30 days. They give birth to a female child, they're unclean for 60 days. If a man has an emission of semen, he's unclean. But there are provisions for all of this. You don't want to be unclean, but if you launder your clothes and you bathe after a certain period of time, you'll be clean again. And there's also offerings, and that's what the purification rituals are about. It's very, very elaborate, and I am going to give us time to get into it because it's interesting. And for those of you who've read it, if you really get into it, it seems strange. But there's an acknowledgement that it's very difficult to stay clean, but it's important because the whole people needs to be clean. And the Holiness Code explains what happens for the people if they defy those rules and are unclean. Basically, the penalty is God saying, I gave you this promised land because the people before you were unclean, but now if you defy that, I'm going to spew you out. So there's a big penalty for being unclean, and that's an important thing to remember. Now, I said earlier that Israel made a big distinction between their nation and the Gentiles. And part of the reluctance was intermarrying with Gentiles. I mean, that was forbidden. And you have to ask, why were they so concerned about this purity? Why is this such a theme in the law? And it's helpful to think that and put it in context. For the people, the center of their worship was the temple. And in 586, Babylonia defeated the tribes of Israel and exiled the leaders. And they then destroyed the temple, they salted the land, they devastated this community. So for those people, in a time of such crisis, there was a need to be able to have their identity, to still be able to practice their religion. And so along the way, this code of holiness, this way of being pure and clean, of having an identity and having boundaries, became particularly important. It's interesting that the purity code was written down, what we have in Leviticus was written down after the exile. So there was not only the purpose of keeping Israel together, keeping the identity together, but countrymen suggest that it may have even been written as a way of laying the blame for the catastrophe of their defeat on the people who weren't keeping things clean and pure. And so in the writing of Leviticus, there may have been both of those reasons. Do you have any I feel like I've really rushed through this whole history. Do you have any questions about it before we I have a little
extra. I don't have any questions, but you know, in the Old Testament, you know, a lot of these rules were for a reason, you know, like not eating pork, we know, you know, all that fat, you know, and the diseases, and then those different sexual things, you know, well, you get, you know, all the venereal diseases were passed by, you know, if you say, you know, I had something to do with a lot of women. And so a lot of this is just common sense
of
the Bible.
It's tempting to look back on it that way because of our knowledge of...
You say that's tempting?
Well, I say that it's...
But they said it before they had this pre-knowledge.
Right.
Would this be God's way of, you know, protecting his people?
Well, I've heard... You're not alone in thinking that. I've heard other people say that. But when you look at Leviticus, you will see that there are things that don't make a lot of sense either, and so that doesn't hold up logically. And in fact, in terms of venereal disease, there was no prohibition. A man could have as many wives or concubines as he could afford. So,
well, if he kept them away from somebody else, that would help,
yeah,
right there.
Well, that's true. I mean,
I have a logical, reasonable mind, and
mm-hmm.
I look for a reason for it. And in this class, I was going
right.
to look for
right.
how, you know, the scripture would, you know,
right.
I'm looking for a balance
okay.
here. Why?
Well, That's what I'm asking too, is why. Hold your question.
The homosexual, they say, you know, the majority of them would have 150 different partners. And they would have 150 each of them. And when you get that many people with, you know, varying types of diseases, well...
We'll be talking... Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure that I would agree. I know I wouldn't agree with that statistic. I don't know where it came from. But
that's not an exact one, but right.
It's a little exaggerated.
and also there have been a lot of heterosexual people.
I don't know the exact one. I have to look in my book. There's none of these diseases. Okay. This is a doctor, and he is acquainted with the statistics. Okay. I don't have that good in there.
Okay. Well, I understand.
Don't quote my number. Okay. The amount of homosexuals, my understanding, are very few that have, we call it, just one partner for 40 years.
I would suspect that there are a lot more than we know, and we don't know because they're not able.
The privacy of people, right. You're never going to have a perfect statistic and on anything.
And not only the privacy, but the tremendous pressure not to let people know. It's.
I imagine the ones that don't have a lot of partners are not talking about it.
Right.
And the other ones are going to say something to somebody.
Yeah, isn't that kind of the way it is? I remember hearing when I was a young girl that, you know, boys are going to brag in the locker room. Yeah. You know, that's sort of one of the things in our culture. Your question about why is good, and I hope that you'll hang in there with me, because my answer to why this law was there is not a scientific one, as you have suggested, but it's as important a one, and that is, the why is because these people of Israel were forced from their home, forced from being able to practice their religion and their whole way of life, and living among foreigners, and needing a way of being able to be who they were in a foreign land. And that the law was a gift for being able to continue to practice and be people of God in a foreign land. And it may seem strange to us that that would be their way of practicing, but that was God's gift. God's gift was, here is a law to guide you, and that it became very elaborate as the priests guided the people in fulfilling this promise and this law. We've got only about 6 minutes, but I'm going to just give you a few minutes. Let's see, how many people are there? I think I've got enough. Would you just draw a little card? We're going to do a little role play here. Well, not really role play. Oh. Take that back. What I'm going to do, I'll explain as I do this out. You're going to be given...
Yeah.
Don't look at me. You're going to be given the name of a character, and there's a Bible verse from Leviticus, either from the first part describing the boundaries, for the second part, describing the consequences. If you run out, let me know. Are you going to run out? I think what I might ask you to do is, since we're kind of out of... Well, let's... How many... You're not going to be here. We'll do... Why don't you just look at it for now, just see what it is, and if you could pass it to someone else, we'll continue it tomorrow. As you'll see, I've given you a different...
What time is your class tomorrow?
Tomorrow at 10:30.
Oh.
You're going to be gone. Yeah, you're going to be working. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, let's just look at it now. If you look at the scripture that's at the bottom of your...
Okay.
if you'll... So you'll see a character and a scripture quote. And I put the quote down to help you understand if you were this person in this time, according to Leviticus, what would your concerns be? And I'll just give you a minute for those. Sorry, if you don't get, I didn't know there recently.
I know what I was.
Okay. If you
what
could.
What would be our concerns?
Yeah.
The role that we're thrown.
Right, right. Just for a minute, put yourself in that mindset. Now, some of you I've given a pretty long passage to, and so you're not going to have time to really look at it. But if you don't have time to read it, you might just take 5 minutes tonight and look through it. And just for a moment, try to imagine if this were you in ancient Israel society, what would your concern be and what would you be thinking about? Do you?
Well, this one says a man with an itchy skin disease on the scalp, you would be afraid they had leprosy.
That's right. And there's a description of an elaborate sort of ritual that requires a priest, right?
It says, if a man's hair has fallen from his head, he's bald, but he's clean. And if a man's hair has fallen from his forehead and temples, he has baldness of the forehead, but he is clean. But if there is on the bald head or the bald forehead a reddish white disease spot, it is leprosy breaking out on his bald head or his bald forehead. And then the priest shall examine him. And if the disease swelling is reddish white on his bald head or on his bald forehead, like the appearance of leprosy in the skin of the body, he is a leprous man. He is unclean. The priest must pronounce him unclean. His disease is on his head.
Reminded me of Mikhail Gorbachev when I read that. I thought of that big birthmark, you know? But, and what's interesting, when you read, there's a whole long section on leprosy. There's even a chapter about leprosy of the wall. And that if there's a wall with a growth on it, that it's leprosy and a priest has to come clean it. I mean, it gives you a little bit of an insight to how different the understanding of the world was, and yet this was a concern. I mean, this would have, any others that who had a chance to look yours up?
They didn't say he was sick, they said he was unclean.
Right, that's right.
I was thinking this probably applies to, do you remember years ago when someone had cancer? Mm-hmm. We must have thought of them as unclean.
Yes.
Because I can remember being told, do not kiss your uncle,
yes.
And here you have a man dying.
Yes.
And they are saying, don't kiss him because you could get cancer. So then when I kissed him, I was faced with, do I love you enough to kiss you?
Yes.
And I kissed him.
Good for you.
I mean, it was scary.
Yes.
Because nobody wanted to go through what you saw him going through.
That's an excellent example.
You know,
yeah.
And all the hurt that,
yeah.
that went on, and we thought we were saying, you know, I'm sure they thought they were telling you the right thing.
Right. That's a very good example. And you brought up AIDS.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there's a lot of education outside that AIDS patients need to be held and held and kissed and all those things. But for a while, but we knew how the disease was transmitted.
That's right. And now, even though there's a lot of knowledge out there, there's still a lot of fear. And you know, not kissing and not hugging, I'm sure. Any other people had a chance to look?
You know, mine says, don't eat blood, or you will be cut off. It says, every creature, his blood is his life.
Hmm.
And every every person that eats what dies of itself or what is torn by beasts, whether he is a native or a sojourner, shall wash his clothes, bathe himself in water, and be unclean until the evening.
And what was your role? What were you?
Oh, Hebrew priest. Well, I guess I'm not a very good one.
No, I think maybe I meant that that scripture you just read is really... Actually, what you just read is really the heart of what this law was about. It's, this is another long thing I didn't even get into, but the covenant that was made with Noah after the flood was an understanding that all life belongs to God. And the whole reason, or the meaning behind sacrificing animals at the temple, was giving the blood, the lifeblood, back to God, indicating that, you know, the food, everything we